Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. Joining me to help manage the questions is Grace Barnett from the Compass office. Hello, Grace.
Hello.
These are unprecedented times, and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and public service workers about how we come out of this mess in much better shape than we went in. A good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in a live call and help support all of our work, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's podcast.
We are absolutely delighted to welcome Tom Clark and Yasmin Khan to help us make some sense of the year ahead and what it means for progressive politics. Tom is the editor of the always excellent Prospect. I'm a subscriber. It's a brilliant magazine. Do get it, because it's always thought-provoking. Before that, he covered social policy at The Guardian. And I forgot that you were a SPAD in the, back in the day, Tom. I can't remember. Who did you work for? Remind me.
Andrew Smith and then Alan Johnson.
Oh, fantastic. Good. Yasmin is a human rights activist and acclaimed author, writing about travel, food, politics via such books as The Saffron Tales and Zatouen. Her next book is out in April and it's called White Figs. It explores borders and migration in the East and Mediterranean. So welcome, Tom and Yasmin, and welcome all of our members, in particular any of the ones, over 190 people joined Compass in December, which is just fantastic. So Yasmin and Tom, let's start where we always do. Yasmin, you first. Where are you and how are you?
You know what? I'm doing all right. I'm doing pretty well, actually, I think. I'm in London, where I've been for most of the last year, which is very unusual for me because I travel a lot, but I'm very much kind of making the most of these exceptional circumstances and cracking on with another book.
Fantastic. You sound bright and breezy. Tom, where are you and are you bright and breezy?
No, I'm cold, but I'm very well. In this miserable time for the country, I've had an opportunity to do something I've long wanted to do, which is move to Yorkshire, where I'm from. So I'm talking to you from Yorkshire. You know, because once you work out, you can work out of the bedroom in East London. Why not go somewhere with a hill?
Yeah, fantastic. And that's been a great thing for Compass over the year. And we should have discovered this earlier, that these are brilliant ways of bringing people together. So, you know, even after lockdown, we're going to continue doing all of these stuff and bringing people even from Yorkshire into our podcast. So, look, you know, this is the first one of the year. I mean, it's just a completely unpredictable, you know, potentially seismic year, you know, bigger than we've probably ever faced. I was telling Tom and Yasmin that we've probably done 4 hours of this, but we've only got an hour to try and unpick where we are and what it means for progressive politics. So we're going to go through a number of crunchy things first before it's over to you. And let's start with what happened in the USA last week. And kind of what does this mean for liberal democracy? These are, you know, we're only going to start with small things, Tom and Yasmin. You know, what does this mean for, you know, liberal democracy? Was it tell us about the state of politics? And in particular, do we think that Trumpism is over and that particular brand of populist politics? Or is this just a kind of, you know, a staging post or something worse? I don't know. Let's go with Tom in Yorkshire first.
Well, I mean, I think it clearly shows that if you play with fire, as Trump has done for a long time, you know, talking about good people on both sides 4 years ago now, Charlottesville, then some people who are not so good will get up to no good at all. The consequences of it, I mean, I think in the short term, it's probably, you know, if you can get through this dangerous transition, it's probably good news in the sense that the Republicans have been exposed as morally bankrupt. They're on the floor now. They might even splinter for the first time in 25 years because they're all going to be making their own scared calculations about how to save their own seats. So, you know, the fraught Senate arithmetic, 50-50, might actually be a bit better than it looks for once. If you want to be dark, though, I suppose you say this isn't a kind of Reichstag fire moment, but it might be a Munich beer hall putsch moment. I mean, clearly these lunatics aren't going to be taking over anytime soon, but they kind of remind you that there is a presence out there of armed, well, sorry, not the people who stormed the Congress weren't armed, but they'll have lots of friends who are, you know, a sort of proto-fascist body of opinion. It's probably only a couple of percent of Americans, but that's still quite a lot of people. And there were only a couple of percent of Germans who were behind Hitler in 1923, and then there were a lot more by 1932. So, you know, I can see the case for being pretty cheerful about it short term, but saying let's keep an anxious eye on it longer term.
And that theme, Yasmin, you know, what does this tell us about the state of our democracy, that they've ended up, you know, Trump ended up winning and getting whatever he got, 6 million more votes in November? You know, what do you see as the implications of that and last week?
Well, it's good to have a contrary view, I guess. I mean, I actually think this is the beginning of a really difficult period for the US. I think it's going to get a lot darker before it gets better. You know, I've spent a lot of time in the US. I go there a lot for work, you know, over the last 10 years. I spend a few months every year there, every year there. And what's become increasingly clear to anyone who spends any amount of time there is that if you thought this country was divided, the divisions that are going on there are deeper, they're potentially more violent, they're more economically profound. And, you know, this comes into kind of, I think, what we're going to talk about as we go on in our discussion about COVID and the impact of that, you know, with a post-COVID, you know, recession looming, with a crisis in American democracy in terms of voter participation, in terms of whether the American economic model is serving its people or not. You know, I think actually what we're going to end up seeing over the next 12 months is, you know, these 74 million people that voted for Trump. I think it's really important to remember that 74 million people voted for Trump at the end of this presidency. You know, they voted because they knew who he was and they liked it. And this is going to open up, I think, something that the Biden team are going to have to really seriously look at, because how do you bring, it's a question we have to look at in this country as well, how do you bring people together in times of crisis? How do you restore confidence in a political system that for decades people have seen isn't working for them? And how do you use innovative methods of both communication and political engagement to try and bring about social change? And sadly, I'm not sure that the Democrats, I mean, we'll see what happens. It's you know, Biden hasn't even taken office, but, you know, they're going to have to radically change their approach to politics, the Democratic Party are. I don't know if they're up for it.
Well, I'm tempted to ask both of you how much you thought that bloke looked like Jamiroquai, but that's probably slightly by the by. Let's take that into then a conversation about COVID. Tom, you know, the progressives, the left, they always think that every moment is their moment and this justifies, you know, their politics and their position, and the people will wake up and see, you know, smell the coffee and see that the answer is a progressive politics. Do you think that's the case with COVID? What's on balance? Is this a good moment for the left or for the right?
Well, I mean, it's been an enormously important moment in terms of pushing forward, if you like, the frontier of what is politically possible, isn't it? I mean, in the things that people said couldn't be done were done extremely quickly. So if we go back a year, you know, it would have been a huge deal if in January of last year, you know, the railways had been renationalised. By March, it was kind of the fifth item on the news because everything was being remade so quickly. And what's more is that things were done very quickly 10 years after the economic crash, which really is the start of the kind of unbuckling of the kind of neoliberal sort of way of thinking about public policy. You know, that had been coming unstuck slowly for about 12 years by the time COVID arrived. And so it's a kind of, it's a second wave, if you like, in terms of, like, you know, the changing of the guards economically, which is why actually I think even Joe Biden, kind of creaky old guy, though he may appear to be and may very well be, you know, might turn out to be in policy terms at the helm of something a bit more interesting than you might expect if you took Joe Biden and looked at him in another time. But again, sorry to keep giving these two-part answers. Like, you know, I think it's going to be very hard for the government to pretend that it, when the virus is controlled, as it will be, you know, within the coming month, that it can't do all the things that it's just spent the last year doing. And you're seeing that in a very micro way with the £20, you know, extraordinary thing, really, £20 increase in universal credit after years of austerity and after sort of 40-odd years of freezing most of these benefits, £20 a week, big increase. But the government's now under huge pressure to not reverse that in April. And that's the first kind of small early test of, like, whether it's going to be able to reverse things more generally. And I think quite often the answer will be no. But the thing that nags at me is just, you know, we've still got the same people in charge and they're very good at using constraints that are sort of objective to do the things that they want to do. And when you look at the level of public debt and when you look at, you know, the imposition on civil liberties that have had to be made on the less progressive side, you know, to get through the the pandemic, they're going to have a lot of, you know, constraints and precedents that might allow them to do whatever they want to do next. The borders of the possible have been expanded, which is good news, but then there's all these constraints that they're going to use as a pretext to say that they need to do what they will need to do anyway.
So Yasmin, you know, what are you thinking? Good moment for progressives. I've been told off to you for using the term left, which I'm more than happy not to use in the chat thing. But for progressives broadly, is COVID a good moment, a bad moment? You know, I mean, Tom's just described how the Conservatives have kind of usurped a whole array of left economic policy. I use the term left already. I can't stop myself. You know, so does this taking the ground away from progressives, or is it providing a platform for us to build from?
Well, you know, I'm an optimist, so I think that it's always good to think that out of crisis comes an opportunity for radical change. You know, with the pandemic, you know, I think we can compare it to the Second World War, which was probably the last truly terrible thing that Europe went through together. And out of it, we got the welfare state. We got huge numbers of international agreements. We saw great cooperation. That does take leadership, though. That takes someone pushing that agenda. And I guess my concern is, you know, kind of echoing what Tom said. I mean, I'm not as hopeful that we'll be seeing the end of the pandemic anytime soon, to be honest. I think we have to really wait and see with the vaccination programme. You know, we could be looking at a few years at this. But at the moment, whatever you think about the Tory party's policies, they prove themselves very effective at being able to both stay in power and advance their own economic agendas. And, you know, progressives at the moment, I think, are very much hindered by a lack of coherent vision about what the alternatives are. I mean, yes, you know, universal basic income we've got, which I think is gathering kind of support, and that's fantastic. But, you know, I guess what I'd like to see a bit more of, and I'm sure we'll come on to this later with kind of, you know, looking at where the other political parties are at, is some kind of vision, which I think at the moment the Labour Party, they've been so reactive so far that, you know, unless they start thinking about this now, in a year's time, when you know, the Chancellor suddenly starts telling us we're back to even worse austerity and worse privatisation in order to get us, you know, in order to repay all the things that we've, you know, had to spend money on, we're going to be on the back foot. So, you know, this, you know, Labour really needs to be setting the ground now for the kind of post-pandemic society it wants to see, and trying to build support for it.
The one thing that makes me a bit nervous with the Second World War comparison is, of course, you know, at the end of the Second World War, you had tax rates that were very, very high, 95% plus, and you had a whole load of resources that were being demobilized, and you had a huge army you could cut down and move that resources into something else. Whereas after this, you know, we're kind of in the opposite situation. There's a parallel in that the state has shown it can do loads of stuff, but the focus is going to turn quite quickly unless we are very careful onto the question of debt, and there'll be a kind of scramble, potentially quite an ugly scramble for who's going to be shouldering that, who's going to be paying for the crisis.
Yeah, and while Yasmin's absolutely right to raise the potential of these seismic moments and what they can mean for a more transformative politics, as Compass never ends, you know, never stops saying, you know, in 1945, you had mass working class, big trade unions, a mass Labour Party, the existence of the Soviet Union, a kind of, you know, Keynes Beveridge political settlement. You had all the pieces were in place for that big transformative moment. What's in place now, which it gives you the strength, not just a voting majority in the House of Commons, which is a necessary but insufficient basis for a transformative politics. What are the other elements? And maybe we'll come back to a bit of that in a minute. We've got so many chunky issues to go through. We've done the USA, COVID, now over to Brexit. You know,
We absolutely have to,
because, you know, what does that mean? You know, could we say now that the split over Europe has transferred from the right, who have got what they wanted largely, you know, to Brexit and Europe being a division on the progressive side of those who, you know, still want to go back or want to hold on to as much of the European deal as possible? You know, let's think about that and, you know, and the implications for progressive politics. Maybe start with you on that one, Yasmin.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about that. I think I found it quite frustrating, I'm not going to be honest, the kind of amount of energy that progressives have put into the whole Brexit debacle, really, for the last, I mean, 5 years, isn't it, almost? And I actually think that it's perhaps proved a bit of a distraction from some of the bigger issues we need to face. And again, it comes back to some of the things with COVID, some of the things with the US democracy crisis that we have. So I think, you know, until we start working out as progressives, you know, or the left, how we're engaging with communities on a local level in order to kind of open up a space where people can feel that they have agency over their lives, where government, whether it's local or national, is able to meet their demands. You know, whether or not we're in the European Union or not isn't going to solve the I think real democratic deficit that and frustration that a lot of people felt, which is why they voted for Brexit. I would love to see just actually progressives taking a break from that as an issue and kind of really starting looking, using the COVID crisis as an opportunity, actually, to start looking at how they can be kind of locally organising to tackle some of the legitimate fears that people have. Honestly, I could just quite happily never speak about the topic again.
I think some of us, at least at Compass, would have completely agree with that. Getting into the depth, you know, properly of people's lives, their communities, their neighbourhoods, agency and all of that. But isn't it equally, I mean, as a human rights person, Yasmin, who's someone who cares about, I understand you think a bit about the environment, you know, about global taxes, about movement of labour. I mean, the trouble is, you know, are progressives doing that level of community activism and community politics? And we still need a politics of the global, don't we? And are we doing neither of those?
Absolutely. We need international cooperation. We need, international agreements. That's the only way we can coexist in order to deal with some of the major issues we have. I guess the point I was raising is, and we have to accept, I think, that we're not going to be kind of going back into the European Union anytime, I think, in the next decade, at least. I mean, I'm going to say even longer than that. So the question has to be, where do you put your efforts? Is it into trying to ensure that the UK is joining, as an independent country, is taking part in international agreements and treaties and signing up to them and implementing them? You know, we're going to have a whole, you know, amount of work that needs to be done now to kind of incorporate so many European legislative kind of initiatives into our domestic law. So that needs to be, I think, a priority now, as opposed to like, oh, well, you know, if we only rejoined, because That argument's gone and we've lost it and we've not been able to, you know, win it again. And there's this constant thing that people do in politics that they're always trying to win the battle that just went. And instead, I think we need to be looking forward.
Tom, I kind of always thought of Prospect as being a bit of a home for Remainers. Is that the case? And is the magazine sort of forlorn about what's happened?
Well, I mean, we've always tried to run a sort of minority of leavers. But like, yeah, I mean, most of the regular writers are staunch on Brexit. Some of them have moved on, some of them haven't, in terms of just where that like little bit of the intellectual world is. But I mean, in terms of where it goes now, I think there's obviously the first practical thing is, are there massive practical problems that will, you know, if like once the Christmas traffic is kind of back up to full pelt and everything, and there's big queues of lorries and all of that, that's going to be like a huge practical issue, which will bring it all back. And we're doing all this to ourselves in the middle of COVID. And then you might see the Tories divided on it. If that all goes smoothly, then you could be right, Neil. It could become more of a dividing line on the left and the right, whether to try and reverse it. I mean, I think, you know, it's almost certain that one thing it's going to do is slow down, you know, in a kind of counterfactual way. It's going to mean there's going to be less trade and less exports, and like then there'll be some import substitution. A lot of things will come out in the wash, but we'll be a bit poorer than we would have been if we hadn't made it harder to trade with our neighbours. But that doesn't necessarily have a big political effect. You know, Japan had anemic growth for 20 years without any kind of revolution. And like, you know, if we were going to have a 1.5% growth and it becomes 1.1% growth, that makes a big difference over 10 years to how rich we are, but it doesn't make a big difference to our politics. The question, though, and the thing that we've all got to keep an eye on, is whether this kind of nationalist genie has been let out of the bottle and it's going to move on to, I mean, Yasmin's interested in human rights, you know, getting out of the European Convention on Human Rights and all the rest of it, because I don't think they're going to take the Brexit, despite this being the impetus for it in the first place. They're not going to do deregulation and all of that. The mood isn't right. The blue wall, red wall, whatever we call it, isn't in a mood for that. The electorate doesn't want it. So they're not going to do that. And so what I worry about is that they're going to move on to the next thing, and that could be rather ugly and could mean coming for human rights.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head, actually, because, you know, there's going to be so many different, I mean, over the next few years, there's going to be so many different fallouts from Brexit. And, yes, there's the human rights angle and all the international treaties that we are no longer part of. But I think obviously the big question, or the bigger question, I think, is actually whether the United Kingdom's going to be able to stay together over the next, however, you know, in the immediate future. And, you know, what's going to happen in Northern Ireland? What's going to happen in Scotland? I mean, COVID has just emphasised even more how it's a devolved approach that seems to be working best. I'm stealing your questions, that's why...
Can I just make it clear that I'm in charge and I ask the questions, and Yasmin's just jumped into the next bit, which is right. We'll keep talking, Yasmin. So, I mean, people thought that Brexit was the big bang issue. I don't think it is. I think it's Scotland, you know, and potentially, or even more potentially, you know, Ireland and the reunification of Ireland. What do you think about those moves, Yasmin? Are they good or bad for progressives? And what do you think is likely?
Well, you know, I actually don't think I can put it in the is it good or bad for progressives debate, because I think that just gets too complicated. Look, you know, I think that nationalism is problematic and challenging. I think that that's why I believed in being part of the European Union. I believe in cooperation. I believe that, you know, nation states need to be working with others. But we have a complete democratic crisis in this country. And if I was in Scotland, why would I want to be governed by a bunch of Tories in the south who are not in any way working in the interests of the Scottish people? And I think that is a bigger issue. Well, I'm going to come back to the progressives issue for us to grapple with. You know, if we're Democrats, if we believe in representation being something that, you know, that we aspire to it being a fair thing, then, you know, how can we not support the Scots in wanting more self-determination? I think that this is where the Brexit debate perhaps is an area where I would rather put my focus. And I don't have any answers on it. I really don't. I think it's complicated, but I do tell you one thing I do think, and I don't want to do too much, you know, Labour Party bashing. I'm a proud, you know, Labour Party member, but I've felt really disappointed, that's a very politician word, in the antagonism that's come out of the Labour leadership towards, you know, the SNP, which I think is so divisive. It's really out of touch. And it's not sowing the seeds of cooperation. And I think that is going to come back to bite Labour.
Chances of Scotland going independent, Yasmin?
Well, all the polls say, I mean, after this, I think that, you know, if there was another referendum tomorrow, I think they'd definitely get it. You know, why not? I think, you know, well done. Well, you know, the SNP have played their cards very well. So, you know, if anybody in this country wants to learn how to build kind of effective politics, I think they'd do well to look at the SNP, actually.
Tom, is it going to happen? Yeah. And is it going to be a good thing?
I'm going to take the good thing bit first. I mean, like, look, I think any of us who don't want to be ruled by a southeastern, like I say this from Yorkshire now, a southeastern conservative elite will feel real sympathy with Scotland, and will understand as well that the sort of civic nationalism up there isn't quite the same as the sort of Brexit nationalism down here. But still, you know, I think one thing we've got to watch out for is a lot of people who spent the last year never being particularly interested in the details of trade policy before because they didn't like Brexit, suddenly getting obsessed about, you know, oh, look, isn't this terrible? You'd have to have this type of border on the Northern Irish front or whatever. You know, all these practical problems that we've got with Brexit and the fact that we're having to fill in an extra form to take our dog to France and all the rest of it, you know, multiplied like across the economy and across the political system, will apply in spades if you make Scotland a separate country, because it's a union that goes back 300 years instead of 40. And so, you know, from a progressive point of view of thinking the world has got too many borders and too much separatism, I find it a bit dismaying, really. And so is it going to happen? I think there's a very high chance it will happen, because I think this has become much more of an argument about heart than head. But I do think that, like, the head will register at some point that all the problems with Brexit are there again. You know, do you want a border, as you would have to have, just like you've got one in the Irish Sea, you have to have one across Hadrian's Wall, and you'll have, like, you know, the same people who were imagining the problem away when the sides are going to swap in terms of the policy because of the politics going in a different direction. So, you know, the SNP instead of Brexiteers who are wishing these problems away, and particularly they won't know what they're doing with the currency. And so, like, there's a lot of kind of nails on which the coat of this thing could get snared still, I think. But I think there's a high chance in an emotive environment like this that it could happen. And Labour's got to decide, hasn't it, how to play it. Immediately, Labour's got to decide what it's going to do if, and quite likely when, the SNP, or certainly the SNP and Greens in combination, have a majority at Holyrood and come back and say, we want a referendum. Boris Johnson goes, oh, no, you don't. They say, yes, we do. What does Labour do then?
And just to jump in on that, what I think you're absolutely right on everything you've said. And I think what gets missed in the debate over Scotland is that really, even though we've talked quite a lot about nationalism, is that I think it's less about kind of a lot of people that I know, you know, in the recent years, you know, more and more people have flocked to the SNP. It's not because they're like, yes, you know, we really believe in nationalism. It's because they see a democratic deficit. Yeah. So, you know, by comparison, only because I've been working on it recently, you know, when I was in Turkey last year and, you know, speaking to lots of Kurdish kind of groups there. And, you know, many people were saying, well, actually, no, we don't want a separate Kurdish state. Or we've already had like an ethnic state in the region, like Israel. It doesn't really work out very well. You know, what actually we want is for Kurdish people to have rights within Turkey. Like, then that sorts out the problem, right? And it's the same with Scotland. It's not as if the answer, and this is where I think progressives do have a role, it's not the answer is like more and more fragmentation. It's like, how can Scotland have a bigger voice in the nation's affairs? How can we ensure that, you know, that Scotland's getting kind of the right amount of investment, the right amount of influence? And I think once people feel that they have that, then the nationalism question starts to wane. Because at the end of the day, people just want to have, you know, they want a communication, a two-way communication between them and their elected representatives. And when they feel like they're just being shut out, then they go, well, fine, we'll do something by ourselves. So that is what the Labour Party should be doing. Not saying, oh, no, this is a stupid idea. Why would you want it? Being like, I hear you. There's a big problem. What can we do, you know, that isn't about separating? And that's a harder conversation to have, isn't it? It's a more honest conversation.
Really hard conversation to have in opposition, because, I mean, in opposition, you can say in sort of Gordon Brown style, oh, let's have some kind of concert of the nations and regions or something. But no one's really going to pay attention to that, you know, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. Most people aren't going to focus on that. The only way that you can plot a path away from the politics of this is by having a government in London that is not an English nationalist government. And that's what we've got at the moment. And until we get rid of it, I'm afraid this is going to bubble away. And it's going to bubble away in quite a disruptive way for the whole way that the country is run if we end up with Boris Johnson saying, no, you can't have a referendum, and them saying, well, we're going to stage our own one a la Catalonia anyway. I mean, you know, we'll be into kind of contested authority. And I think because Boris Johnson, if he's still there, won't have the will to see it off, I wonder whether they will end up folding and giving another referendum, if not this year, then next year.
Well, let's finish this bit with me with a kind of whistle-stop tour around that, because a big impact on Scotland is whether it looks likely there is going to be a change of government. And if that hoves into view, and whether that's a Labour on its own, which is highly unlikely given the stuff we've been looking at Compass, you know, but some kind of Labour-led government, does that, you know, will that change the Scottish question? Is that likely? Do we think that Labour is, you know, getting itself in a position where it can, you know, win on its own or win with others? Tom, what do you think of almost the first year of Keir Starmer?
I've been amazed, to be honest, seeing polls this weekend saying that the Tories aren't tanking at the moment. You know, the performance on COVID is very bad. It's very bad in terms of public health. It's very bad in terms of economics. And then it's just farcical at a level that I would think would cut through to people who aren't obsessed with politics. You know, like Boris rescues Christmas from the experts, and then once everyone's bought their big turkey or whatever, it's Boris says you can't do Christmas after all. Boris says the schools are safe and sends the kids back to school for literally one day. You know, I mean, this is absolute shambles. And I know we've got the press, I know we've got the BBC in a slightly strange warlike kind of mode, which means that it's kind of keep everyone's chipper up instead of rounding on the government in the way that they deserve. But I sort of feel like it's more to do with the media and the press than anything that Labour's doing. But I'm disappointed that in this environment, Labour hasn't been able to cut through, because Keir Starmer has been ahead of the government a couple of times, you know, in the autumn lockdown, on the Christmas stuff, on the school stuff, but it's been kind of only a little bit ahead of them and with a slightly nervous focus group tested kind of tone. And I think He's going to have to sort of break away with a bit more clarity and boldness. And I think he's also going to have to attack them. It doesn't feel decent with, like, you know, all these morgues, emergency morgues popping up and the rest of it, to turn it into a kind of party politics thing. But, you know, I think this isn't just politicians inventing synthetic rage about, like, incompetence. I think it's incompetence. It's very personal to the Prime Minister, that if it's brutally pointed out, the whole country can see.
And Yasmin, I mean, maybe, you know, say what you want about the performance of Starmer, but what do you think, you know, like Tom was alluding to, what do you think Labour should be doing in order to get ahead? And how much should that be like the Clive Lewis manifesto we worked on this time last year?
Well, look, you know, I can appreciate that for any government or opposition, this is a very hard time to be in politics. You know, I think we do need to cut everyone a little bit of slack and be kind with that. In terms of the Tory incompetence, I completely agree. It's the corruption is actually, I think, what has I think got me the most, and how it's just like an open goal that I feel very disappointed that the Labour Party haven't been involved in. Look, I think we're at a different stage of the pandemic now. I think I can completely understand Starmer's approach for the first 6 months, perhaps. You know, I might not have agreed with it, but it was like, look, if this is a national emergency, we don't want to be seen to be too oppositionist. You know, this is a crisis. But there comes to a point where, as an opposition, and I'm sorry, but the last Labour leadership also were doing this, it's a dereliction of duty unless you're really strongly holding a government to account for its mishandling of a crisis that is literally killing people. I do think also that for a start, he should drop the Sir Keir thing. I mean, that's just a personal thing. You know, that's just a personal thing. I can't believe he still insists on that. But more than that, I think that I would love the Labour Party to be doing their own, you know, their own daily press briefings or their own weekly ones that are countering, you know, the government press conferences. I think there's lots more innovative ways of comms that Labour could be utilising. I think we are hindered a little bit by, I think, the fact that Keir Starmer's style naturally is not to be antagonistic, not to be overly seen as critical. But, you know, I think if not now, when? You know, the country needs someone to stand up for teachers who went through a horrific situation with schools, for parents who were left in crisis, for health workers. I just would like to see the Labour Party doing more. And I think that I've been genuinely surprised at actually just how ineffective a lot of the stuff that's been coming out of Labour HQ has been. I think we were all hoping for a more professionalised kind of approach to politics, were more collaborative approach, and I don't think we've got that yet. But, you know, I like to cut people some slack because it has been a difficult year.
Hello, this is Grace from the Compass office, interrupting for a moment. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass and is made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Clive. Here's Clive on why he joined the Compass community.
My name's Clive Lewis. I'm a Labour MP for Norwich South. I've been involved with Compass for 7 years or more and a member for a few years now. My involvement with Compass first started because it was the first left-wing organisation I saw that was really pushing forward the environmental agenda. This was years ahead of anything that was being talked about in Labour at the time, and I thought it was fantastic. I keep supporting Compass today because it's a refuge, you know, in a political environment, which, to be quite frank, is extremely tribal, it's extremely difficult. It's the culture of Compass. It's about asking difficult questions and acknowledging that there will be differences. But actually, those differences are a strength, not a weakness. You can be in any faction of the Labour Party or any faction of the Green Party or the Liberal Democrats or any other progressive organisation, or in no political party, just someone who's interested in the world around them and want to see the world change for the better. It's where I get my political sustenance from, and it means a lot to me to be a part of that community, and that's why I would wholeheartedly endorse it to you.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the conversation.
Fantastic. Over to you now, Grace, to start bringing in some of the members and their questions.
We're going to stick with Labour to begin with. Question from Brian Fish.
So I think there's some symbolism in Keir Starmer's policy announcement where, you know, he said, OK, free movement is not something that we want to get worked up about. To me, that symbolised a bit of trimming to the right, a pandering to the perceived racism behind some of the Brexit vote, and perhaps a signal a determination to win the Red Wall back. Now, you know, the last meeting we were at, we went through all the polling data and everything, and the size of the swing needed will be, it's more than the Red Wall, because it's also all of the Scottish seats. We have to remember that Gordon Brown was a Labour Prime Minister, but also from Scotland. So I fear that this signifies that Compass has a mountain to climb, because Labour still hasn't got it and still wants to win on its own. So that's my question. Do you agree?
I'll just jump in and say yes. So I absolutely agree. I think you're spot on. You know, I think the work that Compass has done has been really exemplary on demonstrating how Labour can't win on its own. And also, I think that we all really underestimate progressives or people on the left, how bloody good the Tories are, like how well, like, you know, how good their comms is, how well they caught the media, how charismatic and charming Boris Johnson is. He is, you know, and I think these are really important things that, you know, that leaving aside the practical electoral challenges that we have, you know, the Labour Party just needs to kind of change its whole approach. And I'm definitely a supporter of the Progressive Alliance. You know, whether I think the current Labour leadership is going to be capable of that, I don't know. But I think that's where people like us kind of come in, don't they, in order to put pressure on them. I wouldn't be surprised if the Tories won the next election. I think we constantly underestimate them. And yes, someone said charismatic and charming. Bloody Boris Johnson. Yes, he is. I guarantee you, in a couple of years, if Keir Starmer and Boris are still in and you're watching them both on telly doing the debate, you'll be laughing with Boris. You will feel like he's someone you want to have a drink with down the pub. And that is relatable. And I think there's this idea that we have on the left that if we have the right values and we have the right policies, then people ultimately come to us. And that is very important. But it underestimates, I think, that you also need to be able to connect with people. And I just don't see that connection at the moment in the Labour leadership.
I feel a bit more optimistic than that, in that I think that politicians, even kind of politicians who are very good at politics, a comms level like Tony Blair in a different way, Boris Johnson, do get tarnished over time. And, you know, I think Boris Johnson is not going to come out of this crisis unscathed. And I think that the relative anonymity of Keir Starmer is no bad thing, keeping your head down for the first. I mean, I wish he was ahead of Boris Johnson a bit more, cutting through a little bit. But actually, if people don't really notice him, and then it starts to get more towards an election time and they start focusing and they make that two-way comparison, I think pendulum swing, there's a thermostat.
Can I just say something on that for a second, Tom?
Yeah.
And the other thing we underestimate, the Tories are bloody clever. They'll get rid of Boris, get him G. You know, again, he'll probably save the day with some budget stuff. And I think, the only point I was making is that the Tories are very tactically clever. And I think we underestimate them quite a lot because we disagree with some of their policies.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, sorry.
No, Yasmin, you're spot on. Like Boris will get tarnished over time, and what they'll do is they'll change him, and they'll change him quickly and ruthlessly, as Conservatives have always done, and as Labour's often struggled to do, to get rid of leaders. But going back a little bit to the question, I mean, look, you know, let's not kid ourselves. We can have PR, and we should have PR, and we can have progressive alliances and whatever. But, you know, the Conservatives got something like 45%. At the last election, and throw in a few right-wing headbangers and whatever, and they're not far off 50%. You know, so it's not like by changing the voting system or getting on better with the Greens or anything like that, that we're going to give ourselves a kind of natural majority. There isn't necessarily, and who knows where the Lib Dems are. People who are stuck with the Lib Dems through the last 10 years, we can't necessarily assume that they're all on the centre left. So, you know, it's quite difficult. There is quite a lot of conservative instinct in quite a lot of the country. So I'm sometimes disappointed, but I'm not surprised that, you know, that we don't have a completely principled internationalist position on immigration. You know, you have to campaign against the individual cruelties of it when it comes to the Windrush scandal and they're putting people back on the flights to Jamaica now. You know, that's what you need to go on, where people can see that a wrong is being done, rather than kind of going complete open borders, because it won't go down. And it's not to do with the alignment or the configuration or the wiring of British politics. It's just that a lot of people are nervous about rapid immigration. And all I'd say in terms of Keir Starmer and how he's handling these things, though, is please don't look like a phony. You know, everybody knows that he's a human rights person by background, like Yasmin. He doesn't come naturally to him to be broadcasting with a Union Jack next to him. It doesn't, you know, come naturally to anyone who's been in the Labour Party for the last 4 years. We've kind of, you know, kind of peacenik, Jeremy Corbyn and all the rest of it. Suddenly you've got shadow defence people putting out videos saying, you know, what makes them proudest about being British is the army. No, it isn't. They're lying. And I suspect that when it comes to like just straightforward, you know, like cutting through with people, being honest about who you are and then like, you know, being realistic about where you have to compromise with the world, because that's what it is a better tactic than pretending to be something that you're not just because it's the opposite of Jeremy Corbyn.
And also the Tories are better at getting that audience. That's the other thing. You know, it's trying to beat people at your own game, at their game, as opposed to trying to move people to where you're at.
Yeah.
Thanks, Faith. I'm going to bring in another question now. This one's coming from Nick Holliday. Perfect. You seem to have done it.
Yeah, my question really is that the State of the Union that you were talking about earlier, we've moved on from that anyway, but that problem is not soluble as the current political scene stands. I agree, Scotland's going to go, Ireland's going to go. I'm very pessimistic about it. We need to have a policy on that, but until the Tories are out on pretty well everything that we've been talking about, we're stuffed. So what are the panellists' three priority steps to deliver a mass progressive alliance in 12 months? That will be the foundation of success. That's what I think we ought to be talking about. I think one of the things I'd like you to talk about is leadership, because I had a go at trying to get Ed Davey to sign up to a progressive alliance before I'd even heard of the expression at the Lib Dem conference at the beginning of or during 2020. And frankly, he sidestepped and he said, well, Lib Dems have got to become stronger first. How are they going to become stronger? More MPs? No chance. So I'd like to hear what your three top priorities are to see us as a mass movement in 12 months' time.
Who wants to go first?
I think that's a Neil question. 12 months. You've got 12 months, Neil. How are you going to
just really quickly, I mean, that is one of the priorities of Compass in this year, to begin to work out what that, we'll call it the progressive platform, and what that is and how is it both desirable and feasible. So it's a big priority of ours, Nick, to begin to develop that and not expect our panellists to necessarily have that up their sleeve, but it's a big priority of Compass, which we'll be talking about, Nick.
If I had to say what three things would you want them to do now, I'd say, first of all, like, you know, like Boris Johnson and the Tories have been behind the pandemic, get ahead of it. And so, you know, like start being not just picking details here and there and should we have really, you know, just go in and clobber them. They brought children back to school for a day so that they could all pick up COVID and then sent them home again. You know, there's no trade-off there. There'd be a trade-off if you said we've got to keep the education going, but they're just like screwing it up. And so hammer them and look competent. Keir Starmer does look competent, Sir Keir. make a virtue of the fact he knows what he's doing in a serious situation, and Boris Johnson abjectly doesn't. So that's a negative answer, but you know, it is about opposing this government and showing people why it's in the interest to oppose it. Secondly, I think like you've got to look at the coming crisis, which is very obviously going to be around jobs, which is kind of natural labour territory. The redundancies are not yet in the unemployment statistics, but they will be soon enough. It's a different type of unemployment from the past because it's going to be, you know, restaurants and things that are closing, isn't it? A lot more female unemployment, a lot more younger people. It's not going to be a kind of full Monty stuff. It's going to be quite a mixed bunch of people all over the country, and you need to find something for them to do. And then thirdly, and this is where I think you can get a bit more progressive, is there really is an attitude amongst younger people and amongst sensible people of all ages to do something on climate, isn't there? And that really is sincerely shared across not only the Greens but the SNP and the Liberal Democrats and the rest of it. And so I'm sure it's an answer you have heard many times on the Compass podcast, but you know, the sort of Green New Deal agenda does link the two bits of that. And so the jobs bit might work in one part of the country, you could see, and the green bit might work in the Canterbury's and Cambridge's and the other seats that where Labour's more competitive than it would have been a generation ago.
Thanks, Tom. I think we've got time for one or maybe two more questions. This one's coming from Pamela.
Yeah, a different tack. I mean, my concern is that when Starmer talks about the family, it can be read as another rejection of progressive ideas that raise problems with the way that family is used as a way of obscuring the lack of equality within the family and ideas of the family that write out the different way policies impact on men and women in the family and in the workplace. So how are we going to answer? What do people think of that and do they agree?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big red flag for me this week, actually. I didn't think it was... I didn't really know what the purpose of it was. I think, So I agree with it. And I think this comes back to a little bit of what we were discussing in the earlier points about being authentic. Like, that for me came across as quite an unauthentic statement. I started rambling because I think I've forgotten what your actual question was relating to the family.
My question was, should we be using the term the family, really? Because I always use men and women, husbands and wives. They're not the same. They're not interchangeable.
Yeah, no, I guess all I would say is
that... Fathers and mothers.
Yeah, what I repeated, that I thought it was... It came across as Labour trying to kind of outdo the Tories on some kind of traditional notion of what family values are. And it just, you know, I would just really much prefer them to be not trying to outflank the Tories on the issues that the Tories are best at, or the Tories, you know... and push forward and start putting forward a different vision.
It makes my heart sink because it just seems to suggest that these ideas haven't been thought about, whereas I hope that, you know, there was a difference between strategy and what you might be doing in the background, but it suggests there is no background.
Absolutely.
I'd say I don't know, to be fair, Pamela, exactly what Keir Starmer said, so I've got to be very careful, but I would say that families are something that people talk about. I can see what you're saying, which is very important to talk in a way that doesn't, you know, entrench conservative assumptions. But I think I'd rather use whatever points you've got, whatever capital you've got to move people's opinions, to do it a bit more on politics and stuff, and to let the campaigners outside the parties try and win the arguments on language. I think talking about language is quite often a political dead end, if I'm completely honest.
It isn't just language. I don't know whether I can come back, but things like the National Childcare Campaign and the Daycare Trust, while we had a Labour government, they deliberately moved from talking about women to talking about the family, but it doesn't work because it didn't provide structures of childcare, all the missing infrastructure that we've got. I think you do have to look at policies, economic policies, and look specifically at how they affect different groups.
Thanks, Pamela, for your question. I want to bring in one more before the end because we had a lot of questions about the US and we haven't heard any yet. So, Matthew, you had a question about America.
Yes, thanks very much. So this was answered a little bit at the start, but I guess the bit of my question that wasn't answered previously was, in terms of 2024, and I mean, you know, gosh, that's 4 years away now, but assuming that Biden won't be the candidate, and who knows, maybe he will, but assuming that he won't, what do the next 4 years tell us about the direction of the Democrats, whether it's more moderate or whether it's more progressive, and what that will mean for a potential Harris candidacy, or maybe a Buttigieg candidacy, or someone else?
I think I'm just going to jump in quickly and give it to the others then. I think it's quite an exciting time, I think, for the Democrats. There's an opportunity now, not so much just with the presidency, but with the Senate and the changing of the fact that for the first time in 10 years, they're not going to be filibustered with some of their policies. I mean, Biden has quite clearly said that he's going to serve 2 years, which, you know, everybody, I think, understands the means that Kamala Harris is going to take over. I can't see after, you know, her not leading the Democrats in, if that does happen, if she does have 2 years in power. And I think it's going to be, I think it's a really exciting time to be a member of the Democratic Party, actually, because I think they're faced with a huge opportunity, despite these challenges, where, because they're now, you know, in control, they have the leading vote, you know, in the houses, that I hopefully they will be able to push forward some more progressive issues. I mean, I think, you know, COVID is the elephant in the room though, isn't it? I think, you know, how the US in particular with its, you know, the challenges it has with its healthcare system and the recession and the jobs losses that they're going through, which is just so huge, you know, how they can counter that, I think, is going to, you know, wait to see. But from everything I'm reading, I understand that Biden's first priority is to just kind of almost take the country back to where it was in terms of those international treaties that, that Trump came out of on climate, really kind of rolling things back to kind of the last year of the Obama years. But I also hope that they move things forward. I mean, sadly, I don't think they will on some of the things like Medicare for All, but that's, you know, it would be, if there's never a chance to kind of get Medicare through for all, Medicare for All through a global pandemic, is the time to do it.
I guess I think we'll see really quite quickly, you know, it's about what's in the 100 days. Clearly, there's a kind of, you know, there's a triple crisis, isn't there? Epidemiological, economic, and also in terms of sort of political legitimacy. As I said before, I think that, you know, the Republicans really are sort of on the floor and exposed and divided for the first time in a long time now. So a lot comes down to Biden and just how he's going to play it. I think he will read what way the Democratic Party is going. We've got a piece in the next issue that's going to say that, you know, whatever else you say about Biden, and of course he's a sort of notorious triangulator and all the rest of it, but he's never an abstainer, and he moves very quickly when he thinks that the politics points to that. And, you know, the politics could point to fairly big changes fairly quickly, but, you know, we've all been disappointed before, so let's give it 100 days and see.
we'll give him a chance to disappoint us, Tom. Thanks for the questions and all the stuff in the chat, everyone. Let's finish where we always do. Maybe with you first, Tom. You know, you've been editing Prospect for a while. You keep going. You keep churning the articles out. You keep talking at stuff. What keeps you going as a progressive? What makes you hopeful about the future?
Well, you know, like, first of all, a lot of things do get better, and it's kind of in our kind of nature, isn't it, as human beings, and maybe particularly as sort of lefties, to kind of notice what's going wrong more than what's going right. But, you know, here we are. I don't, you know, normally people would say, you know, we don't have slavery anymore and that kind of thing, but like, here we are 10 years into a conservative government, and the big debate in social and economic policy in the next couple of months, I've already alluded to, is about whether to maintain a big increase in benefits. Now, you know, we're only, what are we, 5 years from the point where the Labour Party was arguing whether it was right to oppose George Osborne's £12 billion of welfare after the 2015 election, and it abstained on it. And, you know, this was the kind of crisis that helped to bring Corbyn in. And, like, you know, that was a different world. And now we're in a world where the Conservatives have put up benefits and are on the defensive. If they try and cut them back down, they're not, you know, even going to cut them any lower than they were. So, you know, things that we don't always appreciate, because we're always kind of campaigning, do get better. And above all, things change, don't they? I mean, like, you know, so many things are so different, you know, Trump, Brexit, Corbyn, all the rest of it, like, from where they were 10 years ago, that I guess it's a good idea to stay engaged, and partly because it's interesting, but partly because you never know, you might have some effect.
Indeed. And getting from the back of the bus to the front of the bus seems relatively easy these days. Yasmin, over to you. What keeps you going, writing, thinking, talking?
People, really. I think I never fail to, every year of my life, never get more and more inspired with the conversations I have with people, with the connections that we make together. You know, just look at what we're doing now. You know, the fact that, we, in the midst of a pandemic, we're finding new ways to communicate, we're finding new ways to organise. In the midst of a pandemic, we're still having huge cultural issues like Black Lives Matter sweeping kind of not only the US, but the rest of the world, and shifting cultural, you know, narratives around that. Again, some of the policy issues, you know, like universal and basic income, just actually being implemented in small ways, or in small amounts, or thinking about it in different countries. I think there's endless reasons to stay hopeful, but more than that, I think that as progressives, it is our responsibility actually to be hopeful, and it's our responsibility to take that on as part of our vision, and in the way that we interact with people in all our workplaces. And I think that that is one of the key things that any of us, whether we're, you know, with our families or in our workplaces or in our political organisations, the key thing we can bring to any social interaction is to be more hopeful. And it is something that, with a flick of a switch, by just looking at the right things, you can always find.
Yep, inspiration is everywhere. Thanks, Yasmin and Tom. 21 looks kind of daunting and quite difficult, and you've helped us to understand it and work out and navigate the contours of it a bit better. So thank you very much for that, and thank you for everyone on the call. And Compass is going to try and really rise to the challenge of all of that stuff. If other people are not being decisive enough, or visionary enough, or plural enough, or empathetic enough, then we will. We're really going to kind of push ourselves as an organisation in 21 because there's a vacuum and there's a space and we need to do that. The next edition of It's Bloody Complicated will be on Tuesday, the 26th of January at 6 o'clock, when Francis will be joined by another great double bill, this time Peter McFadden, who's inspired the Flat Pack Democracy Movement, and Indra Adnan, one of the co-founders of the brilliant New Politics Champions, the Alternative UK. It'll be a great conversation about how emerging ideas and forces are inspiring a new democratic settlement. So please come back then. We'll see you then. Until then, thank you again, Yasmin. You were great. Thank you, Tom, both of you for your time. You're both brilliant. Everyone, keep safe, keep well, and always, always keep hopeful. Thanks very much, everyone. Good night.
So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast, and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore compass, or compass at compass office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future, and it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.